All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm happy to welcome Ahmed Elassi back to the show. He's on the phone from Cairo, Egypt right now. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, so I hear you were in Tahrir Square earlier today. Let's start off with the good news and the bad news.
Sure. I mean, well, the good news is that recently there's been a cabinet reshuffle that a lot of people feel is, well on the right path. There was the new prime minister, and he basically, a lot of people feel that he's the right choice. And one of his, like, most recent appointments was the foreign minister. And he had a lot of good, like, a lot of people were really happy with the appointments he made, including the foreign minister that he chose, Mr. Nabil Arabi, which was his most recent appointment.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the new prime minister and the new foreign minister?
Sure. The new foreign minister, I believe, is a former UN diplomat, and he's basically he was one of the people that were in Tahrir Square previously, and has spoken out against the regime from before, and is well respected amongst most of the people that were in Tahrir Square, and he feels that there needs to be a major rethinking of Egypt's foreign policy, specifically towards the blockade of Gaza. And like I said, I mean, he seems to have popular support. And also the new prime minister, I believe he was the minister of transportation from the year 2004 till the year 2006, and he was removed by the Mubarak regime, also well respected by a lot of people, and people generally approve of him. And it seems, I think they just had their very first ministerial or cabinet meeting today. I don't know specifically what came out of it. There are no formal, like, press releases or decisions that were released, but, you know, a lot of people seem to be happy about it. As for Tahrir Square, while I was over there, there are roaming gangs of thugs that were, like, beating up people that were doing the sit-ins in Tahrir Square, and
well, you know, we have a headline on antiwar.com right now: Muslim Christian clashes in Cairo leave 11 dead.
Right.
And that's in response to the
burning
of a church. Tell us about that.
Right. Sure. There was I believe I don't have like definitive proof. The word on the street is that it is a retaliation from state security. As you well know, that the state security offices were basically raided by citizens and the army, and they found like tons of like secret files and dossiers on people, as well as like actual torture chambers and like, you know, four-story dungeons. I mean, kind of stuff you would imagine would be, like, only seen in the movies. It was, like, horrific stuff, and they actually filmed some of it, and some of the footage has been on the Internet, and as well as on Al Jazeera and other news networks. And basically, it just showed the, like, lavish quarters of the officers that would do this torturing, and lots of shredded paper everywhere, a lot of citizens actually seized a lot of documents and were basically releasing them. The army made statements asking people, like on mobile phone messages and stuff, asking people to turn in these documents. And basically, from my understanding, it's some of the documents were actually released online, actually, you know, a good bit of them. And there were other counter moves that were saying, basically, if you find illegitimate, because, I mean, the state security apparatus was actually monitoring a lot of innocent people. And they were saying, you know, if you see any of that, it should just be destroyed. It shouldn't be in the hands of the government. You know, there's just no reason for that. However, though, I really don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to make of the whole situation as far as that goes. But the Army did call for every state officer to turn himself in, and that they would be considered, you know.
The Army called for the Internal Security Services to basically give themselves up, to dissolve and surrender themselves.
Correct. And this is a specific branch of the Ministry of Interior. It is not all law enforcement. It is an apparatus referred to as MOLA. And it's basically like a internal, like the equivalent of the Federal Investigation, I guess, in the United States. And they used to do a lot of wiretaps of, like, ordinary citizens for no reason, things like that. And that's what, like, a lot of, like, people were asking for it to be destroyed. Anyways, I think the church burning was most likely like a retaliation for that. That's the word on the street, anyways.
Well, I'm not sure if you're aware of this in the local media there, but there's a piece at Reason Hit and Run's blog, Egyptian State Security Archives Yield Evidence of False Flag Attacks, and that includes apparently a document describing a plot by a man named El Adli and Gamal Mubarak to get back at one of Gamal's business rivals, and they have a partial English translation of the document there from bankofamericasuck.com. I like that. I think a lot of people suspected that it was Mubarak that was behind that Alexandria bombing. That was in December,
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, there have been several local papers that have published detailed things about, you know, descriptions of what exactly happened. I think it was early on, as far as like before Mubarak even stepped down, El Adli, who is actually the former Minister of Interior, he was appointed in 1997, so he was like in charge for you know 13 some years, and basically he did not deny the charges of orchestrating the Alexandria bombing at first, but he said that it was handed down to him from Mubarak himself, and he said that details of which is available in a room, a secret room, which is located underneath the headquarters of the NDP or the National Democratic Party, and it's basically a room that was that contained a lot of recordings of all officials during the Mubarak era, and all these officials would be secretly recorded. Only four people knew about it, and that was Adli, who was the minister, and Mubarak, his son, and Safwat al-Sharif, who was the head of the NDP, had a really prominent position in it. And basically he said that the documents inside this room would exonerate him from, you know, not exonerate him, but it would prove that he was ordered to do it. Anyways, so that goes to this deliberate division amongst people, you know, turning Muslims against Christians and vice versa. And, you know, there were a lot of people, like I said, that would attest to, you know, the regime being behind this from before. So they're trying to do it again, basically. And, you know, to some effect, I mean, they have succeeded, but there are a lot of people that know the source of this, that know that it is not, you know, a Muslim-Christian thing, but rather state security apparatus is just trying to sow seeds of division. And
well, and that can really backfire, too, and solidify the opposition to them for that very reason, that they would do such things to try to divide you.
And from what I hear right now in front of the state television building, I hear that some Muslims have already joined in with the Christians in their protests in front of the television building. But I'm not absolutely 100% on that. I mean, it wasn't reported on any station or anything. Really quick, I'd like to also mention that the Ministry of Finance was literally on fire today. It was set ablaze, just as a lot of places that contained a lot of documents that would be used as evidence are being systematically hunted down and are, you know, and burnt and destroyed, just as we saw with state security. And before, when I spoke with you last time, I believe I was telling you that the Ministry of Interior itself had a bunch of files that were burnt, specifically felony evidence rooms were completely set ablaze. And also the Mugamma, which is in Tahrir, it is a government building that usually houses like a lot of things, everything from like, you know, immigration and passport information to like some army stuff to evidence used in trials and things like that. Specifically things that like have to do with evidence rooms were burnt completely. And we all know, like, you know, who had access to that at the time. That was like a week and a half ago. And moving on to Tahrir today, also I was there like up until like 5 o'clock and or actually like 4:30, and it was just starting to get violent. There were gangs of thugs around Tahrir that were basically beating people that were trying to get in, and they were starting to close in. They had like weapons, you know, from knives to switchblades, things like that, and they were like I guess trucks of, I mean, that was a rumor. I didn't see that. I mean, I don't know if it's hearsay is what I'm saying. I can't like substantiate it, but there were trucks that were brought in filled with rocks, like, for these people, like truckloads of rocks so that they would like.
Did you have any indication who they were?
I can't tell, but there were several that were caught by the people. I was trying to get like the, there are also, I'll mention it, but I mean, when people were caught, they weren't, a lot of them weren't carrying IDs. How convenient. And they were just turned into the army. Later on, I hear the army started using tear gas on these thugs and then eventually just arrested everybody, including the people that were still doing sit-ins in the middle of Tahrir Square. And it's been completely evacuated of people. And curfew was moved up after it's been for the past few weeks at midnight, starting at midnight, going all the way to 6 a.m. Now it got moved to 9 p.m. as opposed to midnight.
What exists in Tahrir Square as far as you know, volunteer security services and what have you? After weeks of this, you guys have got to have some people who are basically volunteer security there, right? Doing something?
Sure. At nighttime, that's exactly what we would do. We would have, like, a lot of people. I myself had my own tent that a lot of, you know, friends and people that I know were using. And we would basically rope it around, and we would have, like, people standing as security in all of the areas that we left as entrances. However, though, what You can't really control it during the daytime, and that's when things get a little weird. Because, I mean, it is open for traffic. It is open for people to walk in freely, and it gets a little hectic and crazy. And that's when, where you get a lot of, like, news media will come and film, and suddenly you'll get these people that will pop up that you weren't there before, and they'll have their own opinions, obviously sent in either by state security or remnants of the regime, which, you know, are trying to just, like, say things like, oh, you know, these people aren't really helping us. I think everybody should just go home now. It's, you know, these people just like sitting here. Things like that. I mean, it's crazy. Another point is there are a lot of sit-ins in universities. I think there was a sort of a hesitation from the government to let schools resume in fear of exactly that, massive university sit-ins. And historically, it's been, you know, any sort of, like, massive demonstration has always come out of universities. So naturally, they've always had state security apparatus, headquarters almost, you know, not headquarters, but, like, big offices inside the university itself. Lots of police and central police, which are, you know, basically riot police. So you have, like, three different types of Ministry of Interior representation inside every single university. So that was one of the biggest, you know, things that they were sort of protesting against. Another thing was basically the fact that they have all of the headmasters and the heads of departments. All of these things were completely state controlled, and they were, like, appointed. And you, obviously, you know, if you toe the government line, that you get a position. If you don't, you obviously don't get a position. So a lot of these sit-ins are basically in protest of that, which, by the way, it ultimately means you get, like, you know, a puppet that will reiterate whatever the regime wants and most likely will give, you know, not the greatest level of education, obviously. So basically the three major universities that have had these sit-ins are a few universities, Ain Shams University, and, of course, the biggest one, Cairo University. And they've managed to achieve one of their goals, which is to remove all Ministry of Interior people, all the departments altogether. However, they were replaced with civilian, you know, university graduates that were appointed as security with, I think, very little training. So there was I've been speaking to people there, and there's a lot of infiltration from, obviously, state security people. And a lot of the kids that were arrested and beaten and charged with, you know, falsified crimes and such recognized officers that had done so in plain clothes actually in there. Now, with universities, you can't necessarily go into the university without having a university ID, whether you're a student or a part of the faculty.
Mm-hmm. So, all right, now, I want to get back a minute to the success, and as you said at the beginning of the show, you didn't seem to disagree, so many people are pretty happy about the new prime minister and the new foreign minister, and I'll go ahead and assume, because we've talked about this in the past anyway, that this is because of the continuing pressure by the protesters, by the hundreds of thousands in the streets, particularly every Friday, reminding the permanent military state there in Egypt that the regime change on the civilian side and the internal police side, that you really meant it and that you're going to get it. And I wonder if there's a new protest scheduled for this Friday after prayers and whether y'all are going to be able to keep up this pressure for the long term to make sure that you continue to get what you want.
Absolutely, Scott. I mean, we are definitely planning on having another big one this Friday, and you know, we've lost the fear factor. So, I mean, it's at the same time, it's just sort of a tough balance because, I mean, you know, a part of what their accusations are is that we're stopping the, you know, the country's progress and what have you, although that is, you know, a day, a national day off, and not a lot of people actually work on Fridays, kind of equivalent to your Sundays in the Western world, but which, you know, doesn't detract from any work effort that people might be doing. So we will be keeping up the pressure as far as that goes. And I'd like to remind everybody that also, I mean, that the actual 19 ministers remained the same. Six were changed. And out of those six, I mean, the most prominent, of course, is the prime minister, who was Ahmed Shafiq, who was appointed by Mubarak. He was also, I believe, a childhood friend of Mubarak.
And, now, is there a specific list of demands about the rest of the cabinet, et cetera, what you want to become of the internal police, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, the most important four, I believe, have been changed. And the most important two, to be very specific, are the prime minister, which was replaced, and the prime minister can select his cabinet. So that was most important, and that is Assam Sharaf. And like I said, he was the former transportation minister from 04 up until 06. There were a couple of scandalous things that actually happened on his watch. But the thing is, though, I mean, basically there was a ferry that would ferry people from Saudi Arabia to the Sinai, and it was very poorly maintained. It was a privately owned enterprise, and basically it sunk because there wasn't enough regulations. And the guy was removed immediately. Same thing, there was also a train crash that happened on his watch, but also, again, because of poor regulations. Which a lot of times, I mean, ministers are unfortunately, it's like, you know, back in the Mubarak era, they weren't necessarily given free rein to set their own policies.
And, well, how close is this guy to the best you're going to get, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people seem to be, and the fact that he was removed before he could actually take any action, and the guy that he... I forget the name of the person that he was replaced with as transportation minister, but he basically made the guy get off scot-free, the guy, the owner of the ferry. Mm-hmm. And no action was taken, no disciplinary actions were taken against any of the people in charge of the train as well. So basically he was taken out of his position so that he would not take proper disciplinary action towards those who are responsible.
Well, you think he was put in this position now because he'll be necessarily weak because of these prior scandals?
I don't know, but it seems that he was taken out before he can actually do his job before. Mm-hmm. And he was also bound by the rest of the cabinet, which I believe was still the Nazif cabinet. Ahmed Nazif, who was the former, before January 25th, Ahmed Nazif was the prime minister, and he was the former ICT minister and of information communication technology. And that guy was bad news. So basically the way that it is right now, a lot of people have high hopes for Mr. Assam Sharaf.
All right, now tell us very quickly again about how people can find out about your upcoming march to Gaza.
Well, it's we just came back from that, and
oh no,
we can,
I'm sorry about that. I thought it was coming up still.
We didn't have like a big march. It was we decided to scale it down a bit to a a select delegates of people from various nationalities, and we were a total of 12, nine of which actually got through. Two of us didn't have IDs. We honestly did not expect to be let in, but the army and the like the army intelligence and all these guys were super awesome, and they were like really good about like everything. They even like provided us with protection and stuff like that throughout the entire thing on the way back, because I mean there are weird things going on. And basically we accomplished two really major things, is that for the first time, you know, a group of delegates or, you know, any group actually makes it into the Gaza Strip without having a time location of any kind, because usually they say, okay, you can go in, but you have like, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours and you have to return. We honestly didn't stay for that long. We basically, and the second accomplishment was that we brought in a symbolic one bag of cement. And that bag of cement really is a very, very big thing, because, you know, while we were there, that our main purpose was to see all the devastation and destruction that was caused by cast lead. We basically went and toured all of the destroyed residential units, and that's, you know, 5,000 residential units that were completely destroyed and decimated, and about 50,000 residential units that were actually partially destroyed. So, I mean, that's a lot. And currently, we also visited people that were living in tents, and it was, you know, for 2 years living in these tents. It was a very, you know, nice, cool summer, you know, like it was like a nice 70 degrees, and it was like a nice breeze. And inside the, it felt like a sweltering 90 degrees, and it was very humid. And basically, we took pictures of the devastation and the current living conditions of people in Gaza, and it was very very sad. We also met with the Samud family.
Where can people see those pictures? Are they online?
We're currently working on getting them online, but it's stuff that I've never seen before, and I've been watching this quite carefully on the news media, and I just never ever imagined it would be this horrible. And we met with the members of the Samouni family, the you know, the live members of the Samouni family, 29 of which were, you know, died during Operation Cast Lead, a lot of which were actual children, you know, with like several bullet wounds in their chest. It was absolutely horrific, and dozens injured from just one family. And it was just a very, very sad thing to see. So, I mean, and you still have these people, you know, they've been living out in the middle of tents, and they can't rebuild obviously without having cement, and it's just a horrific sight to see. And the you know, the type of conditions that people have to live under, you know, these tents. I mean, I hear, like, you know, when it rains, which apparently it does because it is a coastal area, and it does quite often, it, like, the rain seeps right through the tents. They you know, it's a very, very tough living conditions, extremely tough living conditions. And basically the only really good thing that we saw out of this is that on our second day there, we only stayed for like 2 days, basically. And, you know, on our way back, before we actually left the Strip, we heard that, you know, the new Egypt foreign minister, had basically made a very similar statement to what we were making. You know, we were basically saying that Egypt is not a bound to any international law or regional or international treaty to keep the borders closed for goods and services. But in fact, it would be actually violating international law by not providing humanitarian aid to those in need, whether it be in war, even in wartime, you are bound by international treaties to actually, or Egypt is bound by international treaties to provide assistance and, you know, humanitarian aid to people in need. And it's just, you know, shameful that it's not. And basically that's almost word for word what Mr. Nabil El-Arabi had said in a recent statement.
Now, could you have made this trip before the fall of Hosni Mubarak?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So to what degree, then, has the border actually been opened up? Can people, residents of Gaza, come into Egypt? Or only one way? How much trade? How many people?
Zero trade. As it is right now, it is a crossing that is open only for passengers to pass through, and it is absolutely forbidden for any goods or services to go through, and basically it is there is no law or treaty or anything like that, like I said, that prohibits that from happening. And they are letting in, I think it is open for a very limited time, and it is also open for, you know, a one-way, like, into Gaza. People that were stranded outside of it are being let in. And they're also letting in humanitarian cases, and it's, like, on individual basis only. And you have to, like, give very good reason as to why you're actually traveling. In our case, they made an exception, which I'm, you know, very grateful for, and I think, like, you know, the mission was, you know, a great success in which that it was a symbolic gesture that they allowed in. And that was the very first cement bag that ever entered legally into the Gaza Strip. And they're actually being, you know, they're USAID and EU have actually set $5.2 billion that were pledged by, you know, the USAID and EU for reconstruction of the Strip. However, it comes with a stipulation that basically it cannot, you know, they said you cannot use cement that has been smuggled through tunnels and for this money. It has to come through a legal, through legal means, which is like a sort of a catch-22, you know. It's like here, you know, we're going to give you all of this humanitarian aid, but it comes with, you know, a price that, you know, your government has to recognize Israel. And basically, Gaza right now is an open-air prison for 1.8 million people. And it's, you know, horrific conditions for any human being to be living under. And we're hoping that that will change. You know, we're hoping that with the appointment of Mr. El-Arabi, it will be different. And especially in light of the recent statements he's just made about the, you know, the unjust conditions that Egypt is forcing the Strip under. And I think that should be changing soon.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the beginning of it at least. And good for you for being one of the first to go and breach that barrier. I think that's heroic. All right, everybody. That is Ahmed Alassi. He's an activist in Cairo. Thanks very much for your time. Again.